Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. These messages are intended to spark your own reflections and conversations all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime along with other resources and ways to keep the conversation going at fabricmpls.com/scraps.
Good morning, Fabric. It's great to have you here with us this morning. I'm Greg Meyer, and glad to share this time with you. If you're listening via the podcast, we're glad you're there too. We can't quite see you, but maybe can kind of imagine you in the space with us. So last week was Easter, in case you didn't know that, it was Easter. And what we're talking about, which I think leads into this, is that I think there's maybe been a lot of misunderstanding around Easter. It's like a lot of it seems to be, Easter's been treated as a big question that comes out of Easter is, do you believe Jesus actually rose from the dead or not? And frankly, it's just kind of not that most helpful question. There's bigger questions actually to be dealing with. And one of the problems is that question of, do you believe that Jesus rose from the dead or not, tends to divide us, right? It tends to people who do and who don't. It's the us's and the them's, and it's done all kinds of things. And I just never got this intent or this idea that Jesus was about dividing people. I always had this idea that Jesus was about uniting us as one people and uniting us individually so that we can be more whole. And I actually kind of think that, while the storyline sort of lays out Jesus rising from the dead as the big thing, that's kind of like the vehicle, and the real cargo is a little different question, and we find it in a different statement. And three of the different tellings of that Easter morning, we keep hearing this statement to the people who are discovering that Jesus, what happened to Jesus, right, on that Easter morning? What happened to him? And three times we get the statement, go to Galilee, there you will see him. If you were here last week, we talked about that a little bit. Go to Galilee, there you will see them. Like, well, what's that about? The question that I hear in go to Galilee, there you'll see them is like the central question about Easter is, where do you see Jesus? Where do you see Jesus? Because that's where it's actually happening. That's the important place. You know, why Galilee? Why Galilee? I mean, Galilee was kind of nowhere-sville. I mean, that's not where Jesus became famous. It wasn't a place of glamour. It wasn't a place of headlines. It wasn't a place of the paparazzi. It wasn't the place where you go to kind of build up your career. No, that is where, like, the rubber hits the road. For Jesus, that's where he did all his work. I mean, that's where he got involved in people's lives and invested in people's lives. That's where the caring and the hurting and the love and the compassion and the rubbing, shoulders with people was happening. And I think that's sort of that question. For Jesus, clearly life was not a test to see whether you get into heaven or not. I mean, I don't think that was even on the radar. Life is really, was all about this much different question, this question of where are you finding your Galilee? And are you there? Are you present in that? Are you touching the people's lives that way? I mean, we just see that getting played out over and over and over again. You maybe remember the story of Zacchaeus, right? Zacchaeus was the little guy who's a tax collector who's up in the tree. I don't know if you, when as a kid in Sunday school, maybe went through that whole thing, probably learned a song about it. But so Zacchaeus is this guy who's like a dishonest tax collector that nobody likes, and Jesus has this encounter with him and changes the trajectory of his life, and then he follows Jesus and becomes one of his disciples, right? Wrong. He doesn't. Well, he does become a priest, though. No, he doesn't become a priest. Well, he starts a nonprofit. No, he doesn't start a nonprofit. What does he do? He stays a tax collector. Evidently, the world needs tax collectors. I mean, they didn't ask me. The thing is, he was a dishonest, alienated from society tax collector. Now he's a person who tries to bring justice through what he does, and he's connected to community. I mean, this happens over and over and over again. I could tell you stories all day long, but you think about Peter, sort of like the quintessential disciple who can never quite figure out what anything's about, and kind of one of the very last interactions Jesus has with him and says, do you love me, Peter? And Peter says, well, of course, you know I do. He says, well, then feed my sheep. I mean, if you love me, what are you going to do? You're going to care for people, right? And to me, then, with all these stories, the ultimate is the story of the Transfiguration. At least that's what we've decided to call it. This time where Jesus is with his three main disciples, Peter, James, and John, and they're up on this mountain, and all of a sudden this like mystical thing happens, as the story tells it. And Jesus is like transported and transformed, and he's there with Moses and Elijah, these two mythic figures from the Old Testament, Moses representing the law, Elijah representing the prophets, and they're talking to each other, and then it ends, and Jesus comes to Peter, James, and John, and they're like just scared stiff, and one of them says, we're going to build a shrine here for this. And I love, the text actually puts the parenthetical comment, for he did not know what he was talking about, you know? And Jesus' response to this was like, just to shake his head and dismiss it, it says, no, let's go down the mountain. There's a village down there, and there's people's lives that need us to touch them. It's a, let's go to Galilee and go to work. Where is your gallery? Galilee, where do you see Jesus? I mean, the point is, get out there. Do your part in making the world what it could be. That's what hope is. Easter points at hope. That's what hope is. And that's what we're about. So a couple of things that hope isn't, and this is on your outline on the back if you want to look at that. Hope isn't wishing things were different, all right? That would be very passive. Hope is not just wishing things are different. And also, hope is not knowing that they will be different and just kind of waiting for it to happen. Like, hope isn't certainty. I mean, that's nice. It's neat when we know something's going to be different, but that's not hope. That's just something we know is going to happen. Hope has a different role. Hope is having a vision of the world that could be and then working towards it. Hope is having that vision of the world and working towards it. There's this beautiful line in a letter that's called Hebrews that says this. After going through this long list of people in the Old Testament that, you know, kind of lived their lives according to this vision that they saw, now we could, there are dozens there, we could add hundreds, we could add millions of people to that who have seen that vision and lived their lives according to it. And it says this about them. All these died in faith. All these died seeing that hope, right? Without having received the promises of it. But from a distance, they saw and greeted them. They saw and greeted those promises. And they confessed. They understood. They realized that they were strangers and foreigners on earth. Not because they didn't belong here, but because they saw a different world. They had a vision, and that's the one they lived towards, and that's one that they were about. Now, I hope that that's the kind of stuff that this community is about, not only when we gather, but even all the more so when we're out being fabric in the rest of the world and we're weaving all those pieces together for people. So these next weeks, that's exactly what we're going to be doing. We are talking about futurescapes, all right? And you might be wondering, what is futurescapes, other than a word that we made up? And it's this. This is on your papers, too. Futurescapes are possibilities tomorrow that we can start making happen today. Futurescapes are possibilities for tomorrow that we can start making happen today. And so we're going to look at some things. We're going to be looking at six different things. And, you know, none of them are going to save the world all by themselves. But they maybe give us glimmers of directions we could be. Maybe there are little pieces of hope that we can capitalize on and build something and build our lives around a little bit and maybe just readjust how we see things. And one of them, believe it or not, is digital photography, right? Which was, I know, the first thing on everybody's list when they're thinking about hope for the future, right? Well, I hope before you leave today, you're going to have a little different feeling about that. Why? And it's because, well, digital photography has simply become the way we assume people take pictures, right? But it's more than that. It also has a story of change to tell, and it also opens horizons for us that maybe we don't see yet even, or we're hardly even noticing. So that change in those open horizons, I think, is kind of exciting. And we've got Lane Kennedy. Lane, you want to come on up here and join me? Lane is a guy I've known here in South Minneapolis for a couple of decades, I suppose. Welcome. Have a seat here. So Lane is a, I'll just say, you're kind of a world-famous photographer. He is. And actually, there's a whole bunch of prints on that near table there that of some of his stuff that if you want to look through them and pull something out, you're welcome to. Lane shoots for National Geographic Traveler, Smithsonian, all kinds of.
Anybody that'll hire me.
Anybody. So, been doing all kinds of stuff like that for a long time, and I think specializes in wild places, wild things, wildness, but just...
Yeah, I guess it's important that you understand as we... I'm used to talking... I have no idea what to say here, so I apologize. Greg's gonna feed me questions, I'm gonna answer. That's where we're gonna go. But I'm used to looking at a lot of images when I do speak, as I'm talking about the medium and talking about my photography and other people's photography. But I'm a magazine editorial photographer, so when you're looking at the images and when you hear me talking about the medium, understand that it's coming from a perspective of my job as a photographer is to tell stories with my pictures, whether it be one image or whether it be 15 images that run in an article. So that's kind of where I'm coming from in my photography. So it might make more sense when you see we just have a small handful of images that are here and we can talk about that, but that's where I'm coming from with my work.
Yeah. So two things I kind of want to hit in general, but then we're going to dive into some of this a lot more specifically. One is that digital photography, and this is on your lines, represents a gigantic change, all right? Now, if you are, you almost have to be 30 years old to really know that film was a thing, all right? And if you're 20, you said, film? What, you know? Like, in fact, those images, like, there's a lot of people look at that like, well, what's that thing on the left? And how come when they want to shoot a video, why do they have those little bars with all the little, you know, squares? That's something that is called film. It's actually like this plastic with chemicals on it that ran through your camera. And you had to buy this stuff, and then you took the pictures, and then you went to a store or sent them in or something, and they developed it with chemicals, and then you got them back. And that's the only way that we did it. And so people did take pictures back then, like way, way back, like in the 1990s. There was an era that was once upon a time. But there were two things about when you took pictures, and you know this more painfully true than me. One is you had to have your camera with you, right? And most of us didn't. Unless you're a pro, when you never went anywhere without a camera. And then every time you took a picture, it was an economic decision. Yeah. How much do you think about how much it's going to cost you when you click your cell phone? All right. So every picture in 2019 dollars was about 55 cents for every picture you took. And I don't know. I mean, back in those days, I was young and dumb and took a lot of pictures and I couldn't afford them.
But always poor.
Yeah. So... So anyway, that was a true. So there was this huge shift then from going, you know, from film into digital. So you made this transition because you started your career under film. And what was that like for you?
Well, you know, it was tough. I was one of the last holdouts to move into digital. And it's a bizarre way it changed my mind. You know, in high school, I was introduced to photography. And when I saw my first print develop in a tray, that was it. I was hooked for life. I already instantly knew what I was going to do the rest of my life. And so I was fortunate that I had a very good instructor in high school. And so we were able to take lots of pictures. And of course, immediately, I grew up in Alaska. So we would go out and take pictures of each other skiing and rafting and doing all these things. And the great thing about the medium was that I could go back, develop the film, make prints to people, give them prints, and people liked it. And when people like something, what does it do? It motivates you. So you just keep doing it, keep doing it, and keep doing it. The biggest shock came when I went to college, and I thought I was a pretty good photographer by the time I got to college, and you went to sign up if I could bypass the basic classes. And the professor was there, and you bring in your pictures, and he looks at it, and he said, no, you need to take all the basic classes. Oh, man. You know, so ego all the way down. But from that point on, it was great for me. And then I got to know film so well, Greg, that when I started shooting assignments for magazines, it was all film. And you had to be careful on what you shoot. And I was one of those shooters that didn't bracket everything to make sure I got it, because oftentimes, you know, photography happens in an instant, and you have to get it then. Whereas digital, you've got more latitude to play with an image after it's done. Back in the film days, you didn't. So you had to be careful. You had to learn your craft. And that was the most important thing. And then in doing that, you know, I got to know film, especially in black and white. It's such an organic thing, watching silver halide crystals come alive in a print in the tray, knowing how film reacts. Right. And so it was a very personal, organic thing with chemistry, with, you know, raw materials to make an image happen. Digital was very different, making that more digital. Digital is all math. It's all math. It's a very different process. And trying to apply those film ideas did have some blending, but for the most part, it was different. And so my first digital photograph actually happened by accident. I was shooting a book on the Apostle Islands, and I had there was a big storm and I wanted to go to the spot off the mainland, which is part of the lakeshore, the national lakeshore. And you have to walk out to these peninsulas where you can look back and see these waves just eroding the soft sandstone that exists there. And it was a 3-mile hike to get there from where we had parked. And I got all the way down there and I was going to shoot it in film. And then I got there and I realized I had forgotten my film camera. I had just packed a new digital camera that I thought I might try, you know. My goodness, well, I got down there and set up the digital camera, and in film, as Greg mentioned earlier, the economics of photography are such that every shot you take does cost something. But when you can't see the results of that, this is where digital really had an impact on me. Instantly, you can see what you got. And so when you're shooting things like waves in motion, if you're shooting film back in those days, you had to have the perfect exposure so when the wave hit, you got just the right amount of spray. It wasn't too hot or overexposed. So in digital, I put it on there and 3 shots, I had what I wanted and I was gone. I went, oh my gosh, this is incredible. You know, and that's when I started moving into digital. And it's just been this last year, Greg, where digital has finally gotten to the point, because any film shooters in here from the past, you remember the word grain? Right? Well, they call it noise now. Stupid name they call it. You know, I hate it when they change things like that. And but that was one of the things that was important to me. I like shooting grain in low light situations. It's part of the effect, what you're trying to bring across. And finally, digital has gotten to that point. So now I'm there. Now, bizarre enough, film now is called an alternative process in the medium, whereas it's something that I grew up with, so it really makes me feel old when I hear somebody say that.
Oh. Yeah. So this transition from film to digital was big for individuals, like you're talking about. It's also big for us as a society. I mean, as the economy. The economy really changed. Bill Stenross is here, and he grew up in Rochester, and as Bill said to me, Kodak was Rochester. Rochester, New York, that is, right? Or Rochester is Kodak, whatever, maybe synonymous, right? And I have a daughter who lives there now, too. And in 1990, the population of Rochester was 320,000 people, and today it's like 205,000 people. And, you know, why? It's mostly because no one wants them to make film anymore. They lost tens of thousands of employees. I mean, there was a huge upset in the economy. But the point of that is, I mean, how many of you lose sleep now over the fact that we've gone digital from film? I mean, like, a lot of you don't even know what happened. I mean, just because you're in front doesn't mean you count more. I mean, it's like, we made that change. And you know, that to me, that's one very isolated sense of hopefulness. Like, we made that change. We did it. And yeah, it had a lot of impact. It upset a lot of stuff. And a lot of people's lives are really adversely affected. But overall, we did that change. Now, that isn't the hardest change in the world for us to make, but it's one we did make. And that all by itself is kind of a positive thing for us. You've already kind of talked about what you made your switch, but to me, that's interesting. The more interesting thing is, what does digital photography represent for us in this world? And a couple observations about this. So he'll talk about like what it really means to be a photographer and to work with this, but I just am interested in the numbers. What does digital photography mean? Today, this is April of 2019, the number of pictures that people will take on this planet this month is greater than all the pictures taken in human history up to the year 1990. There will be approximately 4 trillion pictures taken this year. Do the math on that, right? A global population of about 7 billion people. Conservatively, about 4 billion of those 7 billion have a phone, a camera on their body. It's sometimes called a cell phone or a mobile phone that is capable of taking pictures. And if on average they take 3 pictures a day, how many pictures? How many of you take 3 pictures a day probably, on average? Most of you. All right. Well, that would add up to about 4 trillion a year. There's not much that's not photographed. But just doing that, if in the United States, if we've got 350 million people, I'll be conservative, say there's 200 million people with a cell phone that end up taking a couple of pictures. And let's say, so that's like 200 million people. Well, I'm just making up numbers here, right? But say 1 in 200 actually decides that they're not just taking a picture, but they're actually capturing something. I mean, they're actually telling a story. They're discovering something about the world. They're discovering something about themselves, which is kind of where we're going to be going with this. We have a million people that are now artists that are discovering the world and telling stories about it that we wouldn't have had otherwise. To me, that's like, whoa, that could change things. Think of the stories that are going to be told. Think about the truths that are going to be brought out into the open that would never have happened before.
Well, you know, one of the things I think about when I hear those kinds of numbers, there's a famous photographer, Alfred Stieglitz, and he has a famous quote that comes out, and he says, your first 10,000 pictures are your worst. So when I hear 1.4 trillion pictures going out there, that's a lot of bad work that's going on. And from an editor's standpoint, that's really the way it works. And so, you know, my craft has always been like your craft and everybody's craft is to how to refine it to be able to communicate the most effectively as we can. Do you have the first slide that we can see? So, typical iPhone photo, right? This is our dog, Crazy Maisie, when I used to like her before she digs up the yard and tears things apart. But this is the typical thing that most people use their iPhones for, and family gatherings, what have you, which is absolutely fabulous, because as Greg said, the economics of it before, you know, you always had to run it, you had to pay for the film, you had to go to the drugstore or the lab to have the film processed. It always cost you money.
And delayed gratification, because I don't get it for a week or
exactly.
Two
you
or a month.
Can see it instantly. You can, it can be on the web in 3 seconds, and you can share it with family, which is one of the greatest attributes of digital photography. And folks, I will tell you right out of the gate that for me, digital photography made a huge difference in my assignment work, because I have to photograph people everywhere I go. And one of the things that in photographing people, a lot of photographers are afraid to take pictures of people because it's intimidating. What if they say no? Well, you know, I've learned in my business, if you don't establish trust in somebody within 3 seconds, it's done. It's over with. You're not going to be able to get them to pose or be in a photograph for you. One of the greatest things about digital photography is I can take a picture of Greg this close, and he thinks I'm shooting his nose hairs, right? Because I'm this close to him. But I can take that picture. I know what I have. I have a wide angle on, so I'm seeing you, and I'm seeing the whole crowd. I can take it and show it to you. And now, he's at ease. He realizes I'm not just taking a picture of his nose. I've got the room, and it's an environmental portrait. It's a huge way to calm the seas when you're out in the field, to be able to share that instantly with somebody. And for me, as well as being an editorial shooter, you know, I always have to get name, age, location, all of these things for my captions. You can't just take a picture of somebody and walk away. So by showing it to them, you've established this trust in a relationship. And then if it's a nice photo, I would tell them, if you want to, I never tell them to give me their email, I will give them my email. If you want a picture of this, I would be happy to send you a JPEG of it. And once again, now the trust gate has opened twice. And so now you leave there and you've had a good reaction from people. You kind of become a good steward of the meeting and that you're willing to share what you just did, both visually and then in the future give them a print. You know, and so Kodak, you know, Greg, you talked about the economy of Kodak. You know, Joni Mitchell had that great, great line in one of her songs where she said, something's lost, but something's gained. So Kodak shut down, but what Kodak did as far as making a film, what have you, Kodak now makes a lot of the camera bodies for other companies that we don't know about. That's part of what they do. So they've maintained a presence, but it's not the presence that we used to know old Yeller for. You know, now it's something else. But at the same time, you know, there's over 1,000 photo apps a day that go online. And so there are people who are making work and generating new jobs based on digital. Your memory cards, you know, the type of cameras, you know, the storage devices. So the economy has just simply gone from Rochester to thousands of other places. And so, you know, where that equilibrium comes in, we don't know, but it is a evolving, you know, process. So when you see an image like this, you know, which is the iPhone photograph, and as Greg talked about, is in the way I communicate, I take pictures to communicate something to you. Robert Gilka, who was the director of photography at National Geographic for 40, 50 years, when I was a young shooter, Gilka had a comment in an interview that I read that just stuck with me like glue. Reporter asked Gilka, what makes the photographers at National Geographic so good? And he said, my photographers have something to say. And that sounds really simple. It sounds really simple, but how do you say that? How do you get that across in a single photograph? Life magazine used to always work on the concept of a single image was greater than the sum of all of the other parts. But then they morphed into a more of a storytelling photograph. So there rarely was one photograph that dominated the story. It was the combination that told the story. How many of you actually read the articles in National Geographic? Most of you read the captions and look at the photos, right? And you feel like you've gotten, you know, the girth of the story. That's kind of, that's the power of those images. But most of the images that you look in Geographic and Audubon, Smithsonian, and so forth, it isn't the ones that you're going to hang on the wall. Usually the first photo, the lead photo, a middle image, and the closer are the ones that really, wow, that's incredible. The other ones are the nuts and bolts. Those are the ones that tell the story, that connect those other dots. And that's kind of what I do. So now, can we go to the next shot? So, you know, the joy of life right there, you know. They were picking raspberries, and I said, do you like raspberries? Yes, I do. Well, how much do you like them? And then she stared at this handful, and boom, there's the shot. One instant. The frame before, the frame after didn't work. Okay, can we go to the next one? Okay, so here's iPhone. And so I just want to tell you a little bit about iPhone photography and how it works for me. This is in Bar Harbor, Maine, and I saw this scene, and instantly what communicated to me was that there was the old and the new. And I went, wow. But it was an overcast day. It was bland. You can see it. Okay, now let's go to the next image. So one of the things that I do, now this is the first camera, the first shot was taken with my Nikon. And one of the things that I will use the apps that are created for the iPhones, a lot of times to create a new image, a new sense of communication to people, I will then take that photograph, email myself a JPEG to my phone, and then I'll use some of the apps that give me opportunities like this. And so I can change that image and keep working in it. Very rarely when I take an iPhone photograph is it the same shot that I eventually send to you. Usually I put three or four different layers on top of it. So now let's go to the next one. So now I added birds and some different color to it. So now it's just a different shot. It's the way I wanted to communicate to my friends, more of a fine art standpoint than an editorial standpoint, to create this image. And I should point that out when I say the difference between editorial and fine art is that in my editorial work, I can't change anything. It's very strict on that. When you take it the way it is in the frame, it's the way it goes into the magazine. Otherwise, it's kind of a manipulation of the public and how it works. Can we go to the next shot there? Same thing. This is the last iPhone type. This is a photograph that I took with my Nikon, again, up in Ely, Minnesota, Will Steger's place, where they have, every year, Will Steger has a ice harvest. And Outward Bound, and there's another church group that comes up there, and they harvest ice from this lake, and then they haul it up to his ice houses, and they have these horses doing it. It's just a fabulous experience to go up and see this. The horses all have bells on them, and they're going up and down the snow, and the sled is filled with these giant ice blocks that came out of the lake. Well, I liked it, but then I took it to an iPhone app to create this vintage look. And to me, it had a more authentic look, and so it's how I'm communicating to get to there. So, but that's kind of how I use the iPhone in communication.
So you're not too much of a snob to use an iPhone?
No, absolutely not. In fact, I teach a couple of iPhone classes, and that's a big part of it, Greg. It's kind of like it's not the tool, it's the carpenter kind of a thing, you know, and so you use this as an expression. Gilka had his comment, Minor White, you know, I'm trained in fine art photography, and Minor White, a great photographer, it was a very Zen-type photographer. He had another comment that stuck with me, and he said, as a photographer, we need to learn to listen to the messages. And Greg, you and I talked about this a little bit. And it's what that means is that when you see something as a photographer, you're driving down the road and you see a big rock on the side of the road and you go, man, that was cool. What was that? You know, think I should turn around. Something called out to you, right? And you keep driving. 20 seconds later, you go, I should turn around. I should just turn around. So you take your foot off the accelerator. I don't know, but I gotta get to Duluth, you know. And so you go a little further, you go, nope, I got to turn around. So you turn around, and you go back, and you investigate what that message was. So this works well with Gilka's comment about what am I trying to say. So what was it in that rock that you saw that was important to you? And by going back and investigating that and using whether it's your iPhone, whether it's using a wide angle, whether it's using a telephoto, all various tools to communicate what you felt is the job of a photographer. We're problem solvers. And when you do that, when you follow that, you define your own style. I'm not taking a picture that I want to please Greg with. I'm taking a picture that means something to me. And that's the big difference in photography, especially fine art photography, is that when you put part of yourself in the image, that takes that it takes that step from being a pretty picture to an image with content. Does that make sense? And so that's one of the big things that we do. And of course, there's a lot of times, especially on the North Shore, if you pull this and you're off taking a picture of a rock, everybody's pulling over. Where's the bear? Where's the bear? And you just go, oh, look at that rock. See the way that line goes across, the way the light's hitting it? They go, oh, boy. You know, and they take off. But as I told Greg last week when we were talking about this, there's another saying in photography that I love to tell people is that, especially when it comes to following, staying true to your own styles, that it only matters that it matters to you. And when you do that, your style becomes defined.
Yeah, that's actually on your Sunday papers. That really stood out to me. It's like, it only matters that it matters to you. Yeah, so there's something like inherently selfish about that. Like, and I would say that that's the truth for me in my craft of public speaking, of preaching. If what I'm speaking about doesn't really matter to me, then why am I honestly have nothing to share with you.
Exactly, exactly.
Now, I don't expect you to listen because you're interested in what matters to me, but it's the fact that if I can't make a connection within myself, I don't know how I would ever make a connection with you. And then you get to decide what to do with that. But that's an interesting process. So when you stop, you say, I know there was something about that rock back there, and you go back, and it isn't just like, you probably don't quite know what it is yet, right? I mean, you have to
explore.
Explore it. Which what does that mean as a photographer? What does that mean? What do you physically do?
Well, it depends. I would say 7 out of the 10 times that I turn around and go back and investigate it, what I had seen, I was able to define. But the other 3 times, I always try to do a 360 around it because oftentimes there's something with the shape, the composition, the design. When something happens that instantly that you go to, there's a visual poetry that's taking place. I find it actually is better on the other side, but you have to go investigate it. And that becomes the hardest part for photographers, is to be able to communicate what you saw by the use of the lenses, the light, the angle, and so on and so forth. But yet, you know, it doesn't work for you all the time. Ansel Adams has a great story about, he's in Mount Williamson, he's got the big 8x10 set up. He's got his lens, he's sitting there, there's a boulder field in front of him, this beautiful, majestic mountain in the background. He gets it focused, he throws the cloth over, he's looking at it and goes, it's just not right. So he moves 10 feet this way, it's just not right. He moves 10 feet that way, he changes lenses. Finally, he gets to the point where he just said, some scenes just won't bend the visualization. So he packed up his camera and moved. And that's the way it works sometimes. Sometimes it's a spiritual connection, other times it just doesn't work. But you know, you can't win if you don't enter.
You know? Yeah, we talk about showing up here. If you don't show up for it,
that's right.
No, there's no possibility. But I'm really interested in that idea. This, you know, you're driving down the road, you're hiking down the trail, whatever, and you see something, and you say, you know, do I want to take the time or whatever it is, you know, to go back? I mean, there's all kinds of little obstacles. But take that out of the world of photography. Just like I had this interaction with this person, and they said something, and we just kind of kept going on, but 10 minutes after the conversation, I'm saying, you know, I don't know that I really heard what they were saying. I think I need to go back. Or maybe it's something you read. Or I think this is a truth that fits in a lot of places in life. We can practice it with photography. Practice when it's easy. So yeah, the skills you need when it's not. But this is something that we need to do a lot of times. I loved your line. You said, every time we don't listen to those messages, we miss an opportunity. Mm-hmm. An opportunity to do, and you're going to find this on your outlines as well, is an opportunity to discover yourself more deeply, an opportunity to discover the world more deeply, and then to share that. And I think that's common. I don't care if we're talking about photography, if we're talking about human relationships, if you're whatever it is that you invest yourself in. But when you get into those places where you know some truth, where you have some authenticity and some experience with it, you know when you're hearing those things. And you can attend to those and stop for those and realize that I'm discovering something about myself, I'm discovering something about the world, and I have the ability to share that, maybe make this world a richer place or not.
Yeah, well, it's the ball game of exploration. I mean, you know, there's times when you walk up to that rock, you know, like in Ansel Adams case, and it didn't work, you know, but you learn as much. I learn more from my mistakes than I learn from the ones that win, because the ones that win always seem to come easy for some reason. And the ones that don't, or the ones I work the hardest at, oftentimes it's because I'm forcing it, mm-hmm. and it doesn't work. Whereas if I just let it come to me, and just through your experience of being prepared, you know, being in the right place at the right time, studying the light, studying the scene, all of your experience that has come from all of your failures, gives you the opportunity to put yourself in the right place to capture the right moment. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of what our job is just preparation. So
how many pictures do you think you take for every one that you end up publishing? Five, three, or?
No, that's...
I'm imagining it's...
That's a tough question. Are any of you familiar with Jim Brandenburg? He's another great Minnesota photographer. You know, Jim, about a decade ago, came out with just a brilliant idea. And Jim, like myself, oftentimes when we go on an assignment, we shoot 5,000 to 10,000 shots if it's a long assignment to weed it down to 30.
Yeah.
To weed it down to 30. That's a lot of work that doesn't make it. And so, you know, Jim has been doing this for 30 years. And finally he got to the point where he was a little tightened up about how much work he was doing for the 30 years. So he said, I'm going to do an exercise and I'm going to shoot one frame a day. And in the beginning, he did it during the winter solstice or the summer solstice. One frame a day, not one roll of film, not, you know, one day of shooting, one frame a day. And he put it to this program that his home up in Ely, a Geographic editor, was up there working on another project with Jim, and Jim had part of this project that he was working on, and he said, what is this? And he said, well, I'm just doing this exercise because I want to really try to learn to focus on my craft and only photograph one frame a day during the solstice. And he did it, and it became the highest number of images used in a Geographic article in history. And it was a very personalized, disciplined exercise in Jim to be able to do it. And if you've never seen it, I mean, go get the book and look at it. It's a fascinating way to look at the world and attack it. So I think what happens, Greg, even with digital now, the ability to be able to delete, you know, your images. I think I've always told people, especially in my workshops, slow down. Don't be in such a hurry to get from point A to point B, because oftentimes the best stuff is between point A and point B. Because oftentimes if you come with this idea of what you already are going to get, you miss what's right in front of you. And that's a really important thing as a photographer, is to slow down and wait for it to come to you and just be prepared to be able to get it. Do you have the next slide? Here's the perfect example. So this is a photograph by Dorothy Lange. And Dorothy Lange was a great photographer during the Great Depression. And I show this photograph all the time in my programs because it's such a great photograph, first of all. But why is it a great photograph? Just holler out, why is it a great picture? And the ideas? The spacing, composition of it. So one of the things that I like about this, and I use as a teaching point, is that how many of you, in all honesty, if you could come across this boy under the tree on the horse, would have moved back to get the whole horse, right? That's a natural thing for us to do, isn't it? You know, is that you want to include all of the information. Sometimes that's good, but if we get back to what Gilka talked about is, my photographers have something to say. Driving down the road and seeing that rock on the side of the road, she walks up to this scene and she sees the little boy on this big horse. No saddle, he's comfortable. If you had included the horse's head, now you've got a competition, don't you? You're looking at the horse's head and not the boy. She has come in and focused on exactly what's important in this image. It's the boy on the horse. That's all we need to see. You know it's a horse. It's very simplified. And that's one of the hardest things for photographers to do, is to shoot tight, as we like to say. Eliminate the extraneous, just come to what's important, what the focus is. Okay, now can you go to the next shot?
But I got to come back to that, because there's a comment about life in that, but keep going.
Well, yeah. So this is an image that I took in Costa Rica. And we were going through a small town, and there was a first communion that was going on. And so all of the families are gathered around the front of the church. All the girls had their white dresses on and their white patent leather shoes on. And the boys all had their suits. They're all teasing each other, you know, and the girls are all helping each other get ready. But what was great is that all the moms were hovering around dressed up. And so I went, look at this. I mean, and I saw this mom with her pink shoes on. And she's over there telling all the girls, okay, it's time to go in the church. Mary, be quiet. You know, just the whole thing, just coordinating the herds as they're bringing them into the church. And to me, that was the shot. If I saw faces, if I saw pointing fingers, it changes the dynamic of the image. The simplicity of it was the strength of it. And so there's an old saying, you know, less is more. And there's a writer that I read someplace that put this in such elegant terms. And he said, never underestimate the complexities of simplicity. And it's shots like this, like Dorothy Lange shots, which I learned a great amount when I studied that photograph, of how to apply that to my work. Shoot tight, eliminate the extraneous to make a bigger point in a softer way. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, it's, I mean, the more you talk about it, the more clear it becomes clear. I mean, we try to be everything, right? I try to be good at everything. I try to attend everything. I try to include everything in my life. And probably the bigger task is like, what am I going to leave out so that I can,
right,
so that my life has a message, so that what I'm about has clarity, so there's a sense of purpose, there's a sense of a presence to it, rather than just trying to get the whole world in my arms, or right, be the hero of the whole world. I mean, whatever it is, like, yeah.
Carry everything. You don't have to carry everything, you know. So that's one of the big advantages of the iPhone that we were talking about earlier, is that I absolutely love my iPhone workshops, because I don't have to carry a backpack and a bag and a tripod. It's just the phone. And it's amazing what you can still catch the phone, knowing that that's your only tool. Your mind goes that way. And it's amazing how much productive, beautiful work you can do with just your smartphone, your iPhone camera. It's really amazing. Can you show the next image? I don't remember what's up. Okay, so talking about, Greg was talking about the transition from digital to film. One of the things that has, for those of you that have ever gone on Instagram, you know, and you flip through and you scroll down, every shot has this incredible brilliance to it. Okay, I've been there. It doesn't look like that. And that's so much of what's happened in the medium now, is that there is a truthfulness that has gone away in what we see in our images today. And for an editorial guy like for me, that's painful, because I work very hard to be in the right place at the right time. And if I don't get it, it doesn't get published. But when I do get it, it does get published. But this is an image of Carhenge. I don't know if anybody's ever been there. It's out near Alliance, Nebraska. I was on an assignment heading to Colorado, and I'm driving down the interstate, and I had nothing but rainstorms in front of me, black skies in front of me. Right when I got to Alliance, it was the edge of the front. And so I went, geez, I know that Carhenge place is close by, and that storm is going away. I might have that chance to get one of those really great shots where the sun's out, but it's black behind it. You know, as I look back towards the east, I went, this could be great. So I took the 15 miles, drove off the interstate, went up there, and boom, look what happened. So the problem that I face now is people see this and they think, oh, you Photoshopped that. And just don't say that within arm's reach of me, because I'm coming after you. But this is what happens. And so it's like this compromise in reality and what's real. And that's one of the downsides of digital, in the way all of these photo sharing sites have gotten to that point where you can manipulate anything, like myself has done, as you saw with the boats and what have you. Okay, can we go to the next shot? So this is a photograph I took for a magazine story on one of the guys in northern Minnesota that trains sled dogs. By the way, this is the poster, so please, they're free. Just take them. If you would like one, just take one. It's this shot. This is another one of those images that, this is back in the film days, Greg, as you can see.
Yep,
you know.
Yep.
And one of the coolest things about being a photographer, you know, you're souping your film, right? You're souping it, you're going through that whole process. You don't know what you got until you get out of the fixer. And you get the fixer, first thing you do is, you know, you're looking at it. Oh no, look at that. This is an old saying in photography, if you see it in the viewfinder, you missed it. And so these are one of these shots that the guy told me that his lead dogs, as I'm photographing him, he had an old Volkswagen Bug without the chassis on it. And he would take his dogs down to the Minnesota River Valley, hook up his dog teams to the VW Bug. It just had a seat and a brake and a steering wheel. That was it. And the dogs pull him around for training prior to winter. And he said, you gotta watch this. When I'm loading all the other dogs into the truck, he said, watch my lead dogs. And the lead dogs, you can see three of them here, they just ran fast beans all the way around the property while all the other dogs were getting loaded. I went, whoa, that's so cool. So I just ran under and laid underneath the fence. As they came by, you know, I got my position, and you don't know if you're going to get enough, but you put yourself in position to get it. That's the shot. I mean, look at that. My gosh, I flipped out. You know, the one's like this, the other one's perfect behind him. Today, still. Oh, my gosh. How did you get enough dog shots to put those all together? You know, okay, come a little closer, yeah. You know. But that's part of the medium, and it's one of the things that we do struggle with now is it real? Is it real? And that's one of the problems we have.
It takes work. It takes discipline. And I love that hard work of you know, what you're going to say no to. I think that's powerful. And, you know, we all get inspired by this, and then I want to go shoot pictures, and mine don't come out like yours. You know, it takes time. It takes investment. Whatever it is that you are going to do well, where you are going to be able to express yourself and tell stories about the world to other people, right. Yeah, it's going to take that.
Well, you can't buy a guitar and go home and play Stairway to Heaven. You just can't do it. It takes years to learn how to do it. And in photography, Greg, it's kind of like getting back to that concept of it only matters to you. I know that does sound incredibly selfish, but it also comes through years and years of experience. You have to go through so many mistakes that you understand what content in an image means. And that's always been my driving force, is that it has to mean something. And for a lot of people, it will mean something, but it's that learning how to play to, you know, when you play music and you first thing you do is you watch your fingers, right? Then you get to that point where, you know, you've learned to read music, so now you put music in front of you and you can play to the music. Then you get to that point, and this is years at a time it gets there, now you're sitting there and you're just jamming and you're coming up with your own melodies. Okay, now you're there. Now it's where you take it from there, whether or not you, you know, make a living at it or it just becomes something that you enjoy doing.
I hope we can all do it in a way that we're as passionate about it as you, Lane.
Thanks for listening. We hope you take this conversation and keep it going. If we are adding value to your life, we appreciate your support of this work so we can engage more people in these conversations that matter for their real lives too. You can do that at fabricmpls.com/give. We'd also love to have you join us any Sunday morning at 10:30 at Field Community School in Minneapolis. That's at 4645 4th Avenue South. There are opportunities for kids of all ages to connect to. Learn more by searching Fabric Minneapolis.